This is Wade Rathke, and it's Wade's World. That means it's Friday, 9 to 9:30. We're on KABF FM 88.3, www.kabf.org, 100,000 watts of people power. This is the voice of the people broadcasting from Little Rock, Arkansas. Wade's World, every Friday, we talk to different people, and we talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today, we're very lucky to be talking to my compadre, Marcus Gomez, and we're going to talk about a lot of things about Latin America. Marcus Gomez is the lead organizer for Acorn Canada in the greater Vancouver area, but he also worked closely with me a year ago, it seems like. God, time flies. In Ecuador, in Quito. Marcus, what in the world were we doing down in Ecuador? That question would take us more than a half hour. Marcus.
Thanks, Wade. You know, we were down there, you know, heading up this political program for Ruptura de los 25, which was a break off of the Alianza País, the Correa's party originally. So they were a group that had broken off from the coalition to run on their own type of thing, their own on their own campaign.
Now Rafael Correa, who's the president of Ecuador, gets a mixed press in the United States. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he's seen as progressive. Sometimes he's seen as another one of these leftist Latin American presidents. But he's had a different case. He's had a mixed record in Ecuador. He's refuge for Julian Assange and WikiLeaks guy. That's how he got a lot of press. But when we were down there, how did we really find Rafael Correa?
Well, you know, the from talking to people on the streets and from having discussions every day with people, it was clear that he was still a very popular president, very loved by a lot of this, you know, a large segment of the population. So it was very interesting, you know, from one segment who really loved him, there was another segment who, you know, obviously found his ways corrupt and, you know.
Well, he got into problems because he was pushing back on journalists, right? Didn't he shut down some papers or threaten some journalists, something like that?
That's right, yeah. I think he had tried to block a media outlet from reporting.
And there were some things in the new constitution he got passed that were a little more restrictive on press freedoms than you would have thought a progressive voice would have been.
This is true. And I think that those are, a lot of those are the reasons that, interestingly enough, that Ruptura de los 25, this group that we were working with, was actually the reason why they had splintered off into their own movement was essentially because they felt that, you know, Correa had been overstepping his constitutional boundaries and that he wasn't staying true to the people's constitution, which had been made, you know, 5 years earlier, back, I think, in 2008 was the most recent constitution.
And many of the people who'd been active in the party, it had never been an electoral party. It had been more like a caucus of progressives, younger people, upper middle class, intelligentsia, artists, and others who saw themselves as sort of a progressive voice within the Correa administration. And
right.
A number of them worked for the administration.
Right, absolutely, yeah.
And I guess one of the things we kept hearing once we were on the ground is that they had left, 100 of them left the government sort of in protest and then sort of backed in, went in the back door and decided to run for an election, as it seemed.
That's right, that is right.
And originally, we went down to build Acorn Ecuador, you and I. Marcus was on loan from Acorn Canada for a couple months, but we were going to build a grassroots program to contact people in the lower income parts of Quito, and that was going to obviously fit in with any progressive surge around the elections.
Absolutely, yeah, it was a great experience in that sense. It was a great project as something that was really one of the first times working as a within a political context, but we
were running a get out the vote program essentially.
It was a get out the vote program. That's exactly.
Well, tell people how it worked. You had a big crew and you hit a lot of doors.
So yeah, we hit a lot of doors. We spoke to a lot of people. You know, we had to make some adjustments due to the nature of the campaign. You know, originally we were just going to do a door to door program when we realized that was not the best way to always get in touch with people, that we had to do a street campaign too. So we called it like Puerta y Calle campaign, right?
Right.
And, you know, the streets and the doors, you know, just hitting up. And it was great, you know. There was obviously a lot of it was interesting because this is a group that had not really ever been established. Therefore, a lot of people didn't even know that they were even around. So it was a lot of just kind of explaining to people what the organization was about, what Ruptura was all about, and then from there, you know, setting out the project of the movement and seeing if we can get people on board to come out and vote.
You know, how they were known, if anything, we found on the streets was almost a bittersweet thing. People would say they respected the fact that they'd left the government, but almost wished they had been in the government to can maintain a progressive voice, because they still saw Carrera as the candidate, the person who should be elected. They didn't take seriously any notion that any number of these parties, because one of the big parties was run by a banker, and this was a surprise. Wasn't he pushing the living wage? You remember?
That's right. Yeah, he was. He was pushing to basically raise the bolsa básica. So I think it's like the minimum amount that you need to be able to survive and so to live. I mean, his campaign was to raise it by $50 a month.
And do you remember how Correa met that?
Well, Correa, just before the election, said, "All right, I'm going to raise it next week." Basically, right. Like, you know.
You can't say he wasn't a smart politician. And then to put the knife in deeper, he said he was going to finance it on a bank tax because that was the candidate running against him.
That is
was
right.
A banker. It was,
that
you
is
know,
right.
This was politics that, you know, you talk about hardball and tea parties and Republicans and Democrats, and obviously in Canada you all have, you know, Harper and all the problems there, but this was, Latin American politics.
Yeah.
This was, you know, take no prisoners, God knows who's going to be left standing politics.
That's right. And you're right when you're talking about Ruptura. They were seen as, you know, some people did praise them for having left. A lot of people did consider them to kind of be traitors to the original Correa movement, though, you know, originally speaking with a lot of people from the party, what I learned about Ruptura was that Ruptura had been formed before Alianza País was ever around, and Correa really liked the platform that they had. And so Correa had originally
co-opted their platform
and brought them in.
Okay,
exactly.
That's important.
So, you know, but, you know, Ruptura did have a lot more. Their progressive views were a little bit further in terms of rights, right? They were very much in tune with like reproductive rights and with LGBTQ issues. These are the things.
And they had a funny position. They had a position way ahead of anybody else about legalization of drugs.
It wasn't
a grassroots party in that sense,
right?
You know, pro women. You know, in favor of abortion. So that actually put them pretty far away from most of the base in Ecuador, at least from what we were finding in the barrios. That didn't resonate, but they were good people. And we're mainly organizing now, though. We made about 25,000 contacts.
Yeah, about 25,000 contacts at least. And
a lot of volunteers we met.
A lot of volunteers, a lot of good people, a lot of great people working for, you know, really believing in Ruptura, which was a great thing, you know. It's a very interesting experience.
But out of it came Acorn Ecuador. So you've been talking and helped recruit Marlene. Tell us about Marlene and the work she's doing down there. And is it South Quito? Where is she now?
She's in South Quito. Yeah, and it's you know, Marlene was one of the greatest political organizers that we had during the time there. She came on a bit late into the program, but really she stood out as the most. The most passionate, the most enthusiastic, and was able, you know, she came back with sheets and sheets of contacts a day. And when I approached her to talk about what Acorn's all about, you know, that's when she became interested in the work that we were doing. And I asked her straight up whether she was interested in organizing for Acorn, maybe a grassroots people's movement. And she didn't even flinch.
I'm talking, this is Wade Rathke on Wade's World. We're talking to Marcus Gomez, who's an organizer for Acorn Canada, but we're talking about Acorn International's work in Latin America. And right now, Marlene Castro she's made a lot of progress in South Quito, from what I can tell.
She certainly has. She's been organized in one neighborhood in particular, El Pinar Bajo, and she's been working a lot there with the community, getting people out, getting people talking, and moving forward with a lot of things like, you know, making sure that there's like the garbage disposal system, that the roads are getting paved, and just getting the community a lot more connected with the municipality, which is an important step in terms of having more recognition within that community as being a part of the city, right?
Well, and land title is a big issue, isn't it?
Absolutely. Land title is... it's a huge issue in this neighborhood, and it's difficult in the sense that everybody needs to be on board. You have to organize the whole barrio in order to actually get to actually present a motion to legalize the whole place. But if not everybody's on board...
So just to give some background, that means that this was an area where people squatted to originally develop it?
Right.
So they were squatting on private land, government land? What do we think?
I think it was government land.
But there's a certain law that after a period of time and certain circumstances could give people title. And that's what Marlene's trying to work with so many people.
Right.
Talk about deep organizing. So now maybe with that context, explain again, they'd have to have everybody agree?
They would have to have everybody in this particular neighborhood to agree and to sign on to begin the process to legalize all of the lands, right?
And you have to have lived there a certain period of time before you can do this?
I believe so. I can't remember the exact figure, but I do think it's a certain amount of time.
And I get confused because I know in La Matanza, outside of Buenos Aires,
right,
it's one of them's 5 years, one of them's 8 years.
Right.
So now I can't remember which one. I think it's, isn't it five in Quito and eight in La Matanza?
Yeah, you know,
Argentina?
I don't know exactly. I'd have to look into it. But.
Well, the point is, and we don't want to distract everybody listening to the show on KBF here, but you can, if you're in these informal settlements, if people built their own houses and squatted them and developed them, you can eventually get certain rights and privileges through government action. This is not the most unknown thing. And I know you've also talked to Yadira in La Matanza. And La Matanza's a huge mega slum.
Right.
It's in the province of Buenos Aires. So it's on buses, it's an hour and a half almost outside of the city. If you were driving as the crow flies or something, it's not that far.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about 1.5 million people live out there, and their land title is an issue as well, isn't it?
It's a huge issue there as well. That's absolutely, yep.
And I know one of the communities that Yadira is organizing in is actually formed all around an old industrial plant site, many hectares, many acres large, that was abandoned in the Argentinian industrial crisis. And once again, once it's been abandoned for a certain amount of time and people have essentially got squatters' rights, and this is not, it may sound surprising to people in, you know, 2014, but homesteader rights were common in the Western United States. If you put your claim and you lived and proved it out, and that also used to be true in Canada. If you were on the land, you could get a title. If you lived there for 5 years, you could get a title to the land.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And that's, you know, landed immigrant status used to be what they called it in Canada back in the 60s and 70s. That's what, during the Vietnam era, what so many people talked about trying to do if they were leaving, running from the war in the United States to go to Canada. Oh, they'd become landed immigrants, find a little piece of land somewhere, 10, 20, 30, whatever acres. So this, but land title is a huge issue all throughout Latin America where we organize. It's true in Lima, it's true in Tegucigalpa. That and potable water.
Right.
Are we finding that issue in what you're hearing from talking to the organizers?
Not so much in Quito, but, you know, the main... One of the problems, at least where Marlene is organizing them, it could be in other areas that where that is the issue, but, you know, Yadira is talking a lot about the issue of garbage, you know, disposal in La Matanza, where it's, you know, there's a little river that runs through it, through the neighborhood where she's organizing. It's basically a landfill. It's been filled with garbage. They've been trying to get the municipality to clean it up. The municipality is an old, you know, apparently it's a group of councillors that have been there for a long, long time, and they have no interest in cleaning those areas up. So, you know, she's been trying to gain momentum within the neighborhood to you know, get more people out. But,
well, and the politics in La Matanza are curious. In Argentina, La Matanza was a Peronist stronghold, mm-hmm. because in the elections, and right now the Peronist party and you know, are in power, but back in those days, it's an area where people go out and buy votes. So
right.
when it has an opportunity to win is right before any election. So if there's no election, whoop, it's hard to get something done. And a lot of the government officials, as you're saying, Marcos, are holdovers to that period and aren't necessarily taken seriously how big it's gotten, the fact that there are land struggles and land rights and so many other things. If we were standing in La Matanza and some parts of where we organized, you see what used to be the huge landfill and sort of burn area for garbage
right.
all over the provincia. They would haul those garbage trucks, would come all the way from Buenos Aires itself out to the big dump. They were supposed to have closed it, I don't know, 10 years ago. And like all these landfills, it keeps getting postponed and whatever. But the this canal of sorts that Yadira talks about is about 20, 30 feet wide, and it's essentially just a big sewer ditch.
Right.
It's got a smell to it. And, you know, there's a very similar one in the Nesa where we organize in Mexico City, where, once again, you don't have potable water, but that one it flushes sewer for the whole area, and, man, you can smell that for miles and miles. It's just some rough situations that, once again, in La Matanza, potable water is a huge issue, and some of these colonias where we're organizing outside San Pedro Sula, water was a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of surprising to hear water access becoming such an issue in Latin America, isn't it?
Well, I would say so. I'd say so. You know, water access anywhere in the world is a major problem. I think that there's a great opportunity to organize around those issues, that particular issue, because, you know, water is, it's a life necessity.
That's exactly right. They always talk about, you know, I forget, there's a slogan that people always talk about, water and life, and now I can't remember it, so we probably don't want to get distracted by that, but, you know, the point is that, and I noticed Mexico City recently, people have always talked about going to Mexico City, Montezuma's revenge and all these things, but mm-hmm. it's truer than we like to admit, but supposedly the government in Mexico City just ordered 68,000 cafes and restaurants and other places are going to have a water filtration system within another year or two. So they're at least claiming to do something about this. Although I was talking to somebody from Mexico City the other day and, you know, sort of wrinkled his forehead and looked at me like, Wade, you know, a sucker's born every minute. If you're believing that, forget about it. But we've won potable water in large parts of the Nesa in Mexico City and in San Juan Lurigancho, the huge mega slum outside of Lima, and in some of these areas outside of in Tegucigalpa. And a lot of it is just organizing pressure. I mean, people are just used to living there, and these are informal settlements often, and if you can look the other way or only pay attention in election times, that's
right.
the way it works.
Yeah.
You're having regular conversations with the organizers in Latin America now.
Yeah, trying to talk to at least a couple times a month, every couple weeks, just, you know, touch base and seeing what's going on, talking about strategies for campaigns, talking about tactics.
So I know in Canada we're doing a lot on the remittance campaign, but mm-hmm. is that starting to be a focus down in Latin America as well?
So this is something that, you know, the last meeting I had a couple of weeks ago with Suyapa, the organizer in San Pedro Sula in Honduras, she was saying that she's really interested in getting this started going and actually getting a lot of the other Latin American organizers to also participate in and kind of getting things going in other countries as well. You know, it's interesting thinking about the remittance campaign from our perspective, because, you know, here in Canada, we're, you know, really working hard on this campaign for remittance justice, and it's the opposite. You know, we're talking about the senders here, whereas in Latin America, we're talking about the majority of people who are the receivers of this income that's coming in. And, you know, it's the same issue, though, right? Where they're...
Well, the same, except maybe in capital letters, because in many of the Central American countries, remittances are the second or third largest economic input into the economy.
Right.
In places like El Salvador and,
right.
And Honduras even. It's significant, yet why governments don't step up and do more to hold prices down and extend access more readily doesn't make sense.
Well, it's actually interesting to think about that, because with all these really progressive governments that are coming up in Latin America that are established, maybe now is a good time to start pushing the nationally and at least have a conversation or sit down and discuss this major problem. You know, with Correa, what Correa did to the banks, you know, with the whole bono system, like you were talking about earlier, you know, it sounds like he'd probably might be interested in something like this at the national level.
Well, that's a good point. If we could get enough traction to actually get it up where it could be considered.
Right.
Honduras, you know, as well, was talking about a whole program in Houston, Los Angeles, and other cities where there are significant Hondureno populations in the United States of having, you know, they give people the ability to vote, and they're trying to lure Hondurans back to Honduras.
Right.
Particularly at the point they retire. So I know we had a meeting maybe a year and a half ago at this point where we were talking to several officials in the Labor Department because they were trying to credit pensions for Honduran workers who had been working in the United States or Canada or elsewhere so that they could come back and still have a pension in Honduras. And I don't know what happened to all these proposals. I mean, there's obviously been huge political problems in Honduras. You know, Correa, for all the pluses and minuses, has had a relatively stable and economically prosperous national economy.
That's true.
What do you make of all we're reading about Venezuela now? Do you follow that at all, Marcus?
You know, I try to follow as much as I can, but, you know, I need to do a better job and actually read the newspapers from down there as well, because obviously what we get up here is a very interesting take on world politics, world, you know, what's happening, world issues, basically. So, you know, it's always about reading between the lines. Even when you're reading from newspapers from down there, you still got to think objectively about what's actually happening, what the real situation is.
Well, and you wonder if this is not just, I mean, at some level, it's definitely protests led by people who lost the last election. So, you know, you always have to look at it with a little bit of a different, you know, even if their cause were just, I mean, is it a spoiler thing? Is it real? I mean...
That's true, yeah.
You know, Carrera, it was interesting, around after we, I guess, around the time that we were down there, not long after that, National Geographic had a big cover story or a big story in National Geographic about the proposal he made about developing the rainforest.
Yeah.
That he would not develop it.
That's right.
If donor nations put up the money to save it as a protected, huge biodiversity area.
Right.
But in exchange for that, he was willing to take a lesser price, but still needed, I think it was $9 billion. But have you followed what happened on that?
No, I haven't. But if I remember correctly, though, I think I've recently read that he did, in fact, whether he received that money to protect it or not. But I knew that there were big protests in Ecuador recently concerning the development of the Amazonia, which I believe he ended up having to...
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think he only got pledges of the $9 billion he was looking for, maybe $150 million or something.
Right.
$150 million sounds like a lot of money, but not compared to what you can get leasing out some parts of Amazonia for development. So I think he finally said, okay, time's up. I'm going to have to talk to the big companies now.
Right.
At the same time, Chevron also was supposed to, you know, they had a big court case for billions of dollars in cleanup from Chevron back before they, when Gulf was there. They recently lost a federal court suit in the United States that says the lawyer for farmers in Ecuador who was suing for the cleanup bribe people, you know.
Oh, yeah, I read that.
Oh, just a tragedy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's hard to believe that Gulf did a great job or that Chevron, you know, might not should have done more. But it looks like they're going to definitely not have to pay any gazillions of dollars. So the whole problem of economic development in places like Ecuador that are so dependent on, as is Venezuela, as are so many other countries, on natural resource exploitation. That's a tough problem in various parts of Latin America.
It's not something that's easily resolved in terms of actually getting, in terms of getting there, right? In terms of what needs to happen for people there as well, right? I think that this Chevron case for me was quite a. You know, it's disheartening to see that this happens, right? Because it just drags on the process and clearly allows companies like these to continue to act with impunity. You know, if I'm able to say that.
I think, you know, on Wade's World, whatever you want to say, you can say. You know, that's the nice thing about having these conversations. Any trends you see coming out of Latin America from talking to the organizers down there? You know, they make such a big point in the regular papers about such a leftist push by governments, but I don't know that we see that.
I'm concerned about that, as a matter of fact, because what I'm seeing is that over the past 10 years of leftist governments, I think even though a lot has been done, I think, you know, people in the middle class and the upper classes are still not happy with the situation, are going to continue to organize against a lot of these very important changes that have been made in these governments, right? And I think that, you know, Latin America, like in most other countries, is a cycle. And I think I don't want to think it, but part of me sometimes talking to people down there and understanding the situation seems to be that it might be moving towards, again, this
pendulum going back and forth.
Pendulum,
yeah,
that's exactly
that's the
right.
Problem. I mean, we don't work in Costa Rica, but Uribe just got elected to the Senate basically to argue against, you know, ending civil war there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the situation in Nicaragua, once very progressive, now a big New Yorker article here in a recent issue makes it seem like Daniel Ortega, revolutionary leader, now Mr. on the take. I mean, once again, who knows what all this is about, but it's very difficult to keep up, and really, in North America, we don't take seriously enough what's happening to our neighbors in Central and South America, do we? I know you studied this in school as well, yeah?
I did, and the interesting thing that, you know, one of the most interesting things that I remember writing about and about learning about was how, essentially, with this whole movement to the left in Latin America, it was in part... The reason was it was after 2001, you know, after the United States government really started focusing on this war on terror, right, where they were more focused on issues no longer in their quote-unquote backyard, and Latin American, you know, leftist parties were able to better organize against a lot of the right-wing neoliberal political parties that were there beforehand and were able to win successful campaigns as a result. And now that you know, this is my opinion, but I think that the states are finally kind of looking back there again, saying, you know, we've not paid attention for the past 12 years. Look what's happened.
Yeah.
Now it's time for us to get in there again.
Well, and the focus is clearly going to be on South America because of Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look what's about to happen in Brazil, both the World Cup and the Summer Olympics. And that's only 2 years away, I think, right?
Yeah, it's very soon, yeah.
And everything you read, you know, the economy in Brazil is challenged. It's not growing as fast, but there are big protests down there, too, and a progressive party. So, but Brazil's sort of its own different force, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think Brazil does have the opportunity to just kind of act on its own because it does have this economic clout.
This is Wade Rathke on Wage World. Today we've been talking to Marcus Gomez, who is an organizer with Acorn Canada in the Vancouver area, but who has worked extensively with Acorn International in Ecuador and continues to help out with regular consultations with all of our organizers in Mexico and Honduras and Peru and Argentina and in Ecuador, where we is the most recent of our organizations in Latin America. For more information about Acorn International's work in Latin America, go to the website, www.acorninternational.org. Marcus, thanks for being with me today. We'll be on Wage World again next week, and we'll probably be talking about India. This is Wade Rathke. This has been Wage World, www.kabf.org, KABF 88.3, 100,000 watts, the voice of the people. Thank you.